All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
Pods on Thursday. Got to start fucking writing that script.
Yeah, but don't worry, mate. I'll loosen up on this preamble ramble because I've got some hot water to throw me into.
Yes. All right, so welcome to a new episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. This week's preamble ramble is going to be regarding the two NFL coaches that have been in hot water, to say the least, in the last couple of weeks. So one of them is the Jacksonville Jaguars head coach, Urban Meyer, and he was videoed basically dancing with a young female that wasn't his wife. And what looked like he was sticking his thumb up her ass. If you don't that's the only way I can describe it, really. So she was grinding on him. Whether she knew he was an NFL football coach and was married, I don't know. I'm going to leave that up to and leave it up to everyone else's judgment. But Urban Meyer, he should have a little bit more responsibility for himself, don't you think, Jim?
I was about to ask you about the Urban Meyer situation. I'm familiar with the John Gruden situation. We'll get into that in a second. But like that little detail you just dropped out there, I can't think about anything else now. So like, I mean, I suppose infidelities with people involved with sports, it's not really a new thing, is it? But if she's proper young, that's really the issue, isn't it, I suppose?
Yeah, and it was also, talk about the idiocy of the incident as well. It was a restaurant he owned, I believe. I'm sure I read that.
That's bait as anything, that is, isn't it?
So that makes it a bit weirder. And the fact that, obviously, you're an NFL coach, right? So you are being paid millions of dollars. You're in the spotlight. Millions of people across the country know who you are. Are you really going to start grinding on a 24-year-old woman when you're like, what, mid-50s, what, got a wife, got kids? Are you really going to start, like, you know, messing about with this woman when you know the camera's going to be on you? So I feel like there's a sense of like real idiocy there as well, along with it.
Or he's like Enron, he got too big to fail. He just thinks he's too big of a personality. He's a, as you say, he's a millionaire status. The NFL is like a massive American institution. He just got too big for his boots, didn't he? He's not thinking about the divorce yet. But he should be thinking about it now, man.
He should be, definitely. I'm sure. I think his missus is absolutely screwing. I think she's been on Twitter just like sort of almost having like little side digs at him. So it's it seems like a crazy situation for them both to be in now. But he's 0-5 with the Jacksonville Jags. And he's apparently lost the locker room and lost a lot of respect amongst the players and staff at the franchise. So we'll move on to another guy that's completely lost everything, pretty much, John Gruden. So he's obviously left his position as the Las Vegas Raiders coach after toxic emails came out with homophobic comments, racist comments directed to players, officials, all related to the game. What do you make of what he's done? I would say this is a hell of a lot more egregious than what Urban Meyer's done.
Well, he got done twice, didn't he? So initially, it was a journalist from the Wall Street Journal that uncovered an email containing this kind of material. And then the NFL itself found a whole batch of emails containing the same sort of misogynistic, homophobic, racist slurs. When they were investigating the working culture at the Washington football team, I think that's what happened. That's how it was described in the article that I read anyway. But it would be disingenuous of me to point the finger at him and say, that's terrible, that's outrageous. Because I can't sit here and say that I haven't said misogynistic, homophobic and racist things in my life. So I can't play holier than that and keep a straight face, because it's just not true, is it, man?
Yeah, but I mean, I would say there's a big difference between like a little bit of banter in the WhatsApp group and sending out official emails to people within your organization directly attacking certain people that are related to your organization. So I think there was the first openly gay NFL player. I think his name's Michael Sam in 2014. He said something along the lines of, I think the commissioner, Roger Goodell, was forcing them to take, say, faggot player or something along those lines, I think he said. So he's directly attacking certain players.
Yes, that is different. Because, like, obviously, I didn't really think about that aspect of it, that banter with your mates is, whatever you think of what's actually being said, it's not meant for public consumption. Whereas official emails, that's blatant, especially if you're in a position of power and you're actually talking about people who you've got direct influence over. So yeah, I suppose that is a bit of a different year, because someone who's willing to do that, if they're just letting those little bits slip out in official documents, can you imagine what they're really like when doors are closed and all that? So yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
it's going to be 10 times worse, isn't it? And yeah, you know, is this kind of an indictment of the general sort of industry as a whole? So is it like is there a toxic culture amongst the sort of, you know, NFL coaches that are around this sort of age? Is this going to be the sort of last time we see coaches this age with this kind of mindset? Are they going to eventually just filter out, and we're going to see a lot more sort of progressive coaches that perhaps haven't got this sort of like old school mentality of, I feel like there's going to be a bit of a change in the guard when these sort of coaches sort of like, you know, filter out.
Yeah, it's definitely that's what's going to happen, because every decade, imagine like growing up in the 70s, like 70s, 60s, like you're obviously going to have different attitudes towards race and sexuality and gender politics and all that kind of stuff than you would have if you grew up in the late 80s, early 90s. So it's just the way things are, isn't it? And that's the trend that our Western, especially the UK and America, that's the trend we've taken. So I would say, yeah, not without a shadow, because anything can happen, but I would bet it going that way. And it's all for the better, isn't it, really? Like the less hate in the world, the better. So yeah, I would hope so.
Yeah, for sure. Good way to end it. All right, so we'll crack on with the five things you might have missed. Number one is from American soccer. So 13-year-old Axel Kai became the youngest player ever to appear in a professional American sports league this weekend when he turned out for the Real Monarchs in the USL Championship, who I think are Real Salt Lake's B team, essentially. So the USL Championship is the league below the MLS that runs concurrent with the NCAA college soccer rankings and offers an alternate path to the MLS. So it's not quite, you know, obviously they don't have the promotion relegation in America, do they? So it's kind of like you can't really get promoted with your team, but if you do a good job in the USL, you can get sort of like lifted up to the A team. So it's almost like a sort of development league. So he supersedes Fred Yeadeau as the youngest soccer player to appear for an American professional sports team, FM Classic, but has yet to cement a contract in the MLS that would surely make him the youngest ever player play in a top recognized sports league. And despite his younger age, Kay isn't quite the youngest footballer ever. That honour remains with Bolivian midfielder Mauricio Baldivieso, who was brought on as a late substitute by his father, of course he was, for Bolivian first division side Aurora in 2008, just a few days shy of his 13th birthday.
I was still playing with action figures when I was 13. I hope Freddy Adu's career trajectory isn't a harbinger of what's going to come for, is it K?
Axel K, yeah.
Axel K, we'll go with K. But yeah, you'd hope that obviously exposure and game time and big expectations can really derail a young player's trajectory. I mean, look at what's happening with Beckham's kids and all that kind of stuff. It's a lot of pressure, man. So I would hope the developmental league and that kind of lower level of competition will bring him along at the right pace. But the fact that you're hearing about him and I'm hearing about him already kind of suggests that there's going to be a lot of spotlight on this kid.
And we know that, you know, the earlier that players are exposed to sort of elite level football, the quicker their career turns, shorter lasting their career is. For example, like Wayne Rooney coming on the scene at 16 years old, he didn't really live past, what, 30 in terms of his career.
30, I want to say 33.
But that he'd moved to Derby by that point. And when he was 32, yeah, he'd lost all his pace. He'd lost his sort of, he couldn't really play striker anymore because he didn't have the same sort of attributes as he did when he was 16. Yeah. So he had to sort of like evolve, really. And he was a great footballer. Like, he dropped back into some more of a midfield position. Danini's sort of like his early 30s. And then obviously he moved to Derby and had a few games there. So you think the earlier that they come on the scene, with the exception of, say, Cristiano Ronaldo, he's
an anomaly, isn't it? Yeah.
So, but most of these footballers that come onto the scene early, they do end up finishing their careers early as well. So it's not as long lasting. So I think players at that age need to be, because they haven't fully developed yet, have they, mentally or physically? So yeah, it's like, how do you manage that? How do you sort of load management is a big thing. So you don't want to give him too much game time. Same thing's happening with a striker called Ricardo Pepi, who's, I think he's 18 at the minute. He's playing for the US national team and they're trying to make sure that his load isn't too much at his age. He's playing a lot of football already on the international scene already. So, you know, potentially he could move on to bigger things. He's a very good player. So it's very important that these young players, like, their game time's managed and their physical load is managed.
Well, segue international here. The physical side of football is what we're just addressing here. But the personal interaction between players and coaches is what this number two is all about. Now, I wouldn't usually comment on this because it's basically like gossip, but I've seen it pop up from quite a few different outlets. And it regards former Chelsea coach Eddie Newton's comments saying that he believes Mo Salah and Kevin De Bruyne left Chelsea because of a personality clash with Jose Mourinho. Now, this strikes me as pretty much a standard part of professional football, but the implication was that Jose made a bit of a horrible misstep by allowing players of such great quality to slip through his fingers. Now, what do you think about all of that?
I mean, first off, I think that's the Eddie Newton that used to play for Blues. I think he played for Chelsea as well, didn't he? I've just had a look at him. He played, made four appearances for Birmingham City. Remember the first LMA manager? He was playing for Blues at that point. He was a great little player on the first LMA. Back when I was 9 years old, when I was first getting into the world of gaming and football management. So, Jose, so I think he's admitting to the fact that he maybe made mistakes in letting players of that quality leave Chelsea at the time?
No, this is Eddie Newton saying football wasn't the issue with them. It's not like they weren't good enough for the team, because he also said about Lukaku, he left around a similar time and went on that journey that's basically taken him the better part of 10 years to get back to Chelsea. But Newton was saying that Lukaku wasn't ready. De Bruyne and Salah were. And it was a clash of personalities with Jose Mourinho. And just by chance, just before I've come on the pod here today, I watched a TIFO football video that was talking about Nagelsmann, the Bayern coach, saying that football management is 30% tactics and 70% social competence.
I can fully agree with that. I think that's a great quote for sure. Because at the end of the day, as a coach, you're not just a manager in the sense that, all right, you change the tactics or you can really make that much of an effect. These are elite level footballers, man. They've basically got all the skills and technique in their locker already before that you come into the scene. So you are you need to be a social competent manager. You need to manage people emotionally. You need to have good emotional intelligence. So it's a lot more than just the tactics that you employ on the field. And I think that's why a lot of these younger coaches that are a bit more cerebral in the way that they approach coaching are having a lot more success now. And that's perhaps why, I don't know, I'm not going to say Jose Mourinho isn't successful now, but he hasn't been as successful as he was maybe when he was in his younger years. And yeah. I'm not sure how much of that is down to the fact that he has an arrogant persona, doesn't he? He doesn't seem to me the sort of coach that's very good at having a shoulder to lean on for players, you know what I mean? And being able to sort of like emotionally develop players. Whereas the coaches like Tuchel do seem to have that persona about him. He seems to genuinely care about every single player in his team. So I wonder how much of an effect that makes, especially with like, we're in the age of social media where there's a lot more emphasis on the mental health and the mental stability of sports people. I feel like that part of that facet of coaching is becoming ever present and even more important than it perhaps was, say, 10, 15 years ago.
And also, as Jose Mourinho gets older, he's got to be, what, 50s now, mid-50s?
Yeah.
And most dressing rooms are always going to be early to late 20s. Yep. So the dressing room age, no matter about the personnel, is always going to stay around about the same.
Yep.
So yeah, maybe he did, man, because I can see him, like, he's had famous fallouts with loads of people, but also when he went to Inter and won the treble with them, like, they all loved him. So I suppose that was just the perfect recipe for the perfect time. And because he's so combative, and as you say, has that arrogant persona, it's always going to rub players the wrong way, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I think Zlatan Ibrahimovic had a bit of a sort of hot and cold relationship as well. You know, there's been sort of very famous players that have been coached by him that have been like, yeah, he's kind of like a bit hit and miss at times. And he can sort of like drop you, like he can build a good relationship with you, but then he's not afraid to just cut ties with you if he feels that you're not fitting into the right moment or you know, you're not fitting into his system or whatever. So yeah, he seems like a very difficult sort of personality, to be honest, on and off the field. All right, so number three, let me introduce, because this is something that I I've literally found out about this week. So let me introduce you to something called fan-controlled football. So this is a professional indoor football league created in 2017. So this is American football, as the first sports league controlled entirely by fans. So this is some utopian shit. So I had to do a little bit of reading up about this. But just to quote Wikipedia, because that is the great source of all information. Yeah. Players are paid weekly minimums of $400 to $750. So not very much. Plus room and board. So it sounds like a military camp or something. Coaches get paid a lot more than this, by the way. So this might be where John Gruden will be headed straight after his exit from Las Vegas.
Yeah.
So coaches get paid $3,500 per month with housing and meal plan. So it's pretty interesting. It sounds like something out of Hunger Games or Squid Game. Do you know what I mean?
And I was just thinking that. Get your green tracksuits on, mate. Hunker down for the night.
So it's like the sports Squid Game. So this was created in 2017, but I think they've had their inaugural season this year. And there's only four teams. So unless I'm mistaken, by reading up on it, it seems that fans can basically choose the players that they want to start. So I think it's all done through, it's all streamed via Twitch, I think, and Ven, whatever Ven is broadcasting platform. And I think basically the fans control the team. So they choose who to cut, who to sign, who to play. So it's really sort of like innovative in that way. And I'm not sure if they choose the tactics. I think they might actually choose what plays that the team does. So I don't know. I don't know what the coaches have to do, and I don't know why they're getting paid like 10 times the amount that the players are getting paid. So,
yeah, I was just thinking that they're like a puppet dictators, aren't they? The managers, man. But like, how do they corral it in? So like the fans, they just vote. It's just open season. You can just vote.
Let's have a look. I haven't done that much research on it, unfortunately. It was just sort of a fleeting moment because I was looking at a player called Johnny Manziel. So he's one of the biggest busts in the NFL in recent memory. I think he was like 2017. He was drafted roughly the same time that this was founded. And he got drafted by the Cleveland Browns and he was absolutely shocking. He just couldn't deal with the adjustment really from college to NFL. And his characteristics just weren't made for it, man. He was just out partying every night. After losses, he was going to Las Vegas getting fucked up. So like he weren't built for it. He weren't emotionally, he was not built for like taking that next step, but had loads of talent. So he's now playing in this league. So if he's playing, how down in the dumps must he be to be getting paid like $750 a week?
It's perfect for him because he just needs to use his physical attributes and all the responsibilities taken off his shoulders. He knows himself, that lad. He knows himself. 10 years from now, he's going to be a Hall of Famer in the, I can't remember what it's called now. What's it called?
The fan control football league.
Fan controlled football league. First ballot Hall of Famer, man.
Is what it says on the tin. Do you know what I mean? So it's like there's some team owner, very famous team owners. So there's like Mike Tyson, Greg Miller, some ex NFL players, some current NFL players, Dalvin Cook, ex players, Marshawn Lynch, Richard Sherman, Austin Eckler, who plays currently in the league. So there's quite a lot of famous players that are involved in it. And they want to build the four teams that they currently have, which are called the Beasts, the Glacier Boys, the Wild Aces, and the Zappers.
The Frank Zappers, mate.
Frank Zappers. So the Wild Aces beat the Glacier Boys 46-40 in the first championship for this league. So this is going to be really, really interesting to see where this goes, man. And I'd love to see if this can permeate its way into other sports.
The Glacier Boys sound like a male stripping truth, man. Fair play to them. They're absolutely killing it. But, okay, so I can't stop thinking about this idea, the fan-controlled football. But, like, Mike Tyson's got in on the ground floor, but he's taking mushrooms every day, so I don't really know.
So somebody's managed to get some money off him somehow, do you know what I mean? I don't know how they've managed to swindle him, but I don't know why he'd be interested in this. But
well, this ain't the maddest thing that's been happening in sports over the past few weeks. I mean, I don't think a second has gone by since this this takeover of Newcastle United, man, that I haven't seen some more mind-boggling news about what their plans are. But like, so obviously it's Mohammed, is it Salman? I'm fucking up his name.
Mohammed
his
bin name? Salman, is it? Mohammed bin Salman.
There he is, Mohammed bin Salman.
He's probably got another few names thrown in there, but just for...
Yeah, Mohammed bin Salman Al Saud. Yeah, that's the bit. Every time, I can't remember his name. But so he's the figurehead behind and let me get this right now, Saudi Arabia's public investment fund, which have
in the Saudi government, basically.
The Saudi government. So they've confirmed their takeover of Newcastle United officially this week. I think they were waiting on some kind of piracy rights with BN,
that kind of thing. Yeah.
So that's gone through now. But now they're on about taking over Inter Milan. What is going on? the Chinese owners of Inter Milan, Suning, obviously, they had to get rid of loads of players in the summer. They've overspent in past seasons. And now they're not just taking over Newcastle, a bog standard team since the 90s. And they're just going to turn them into the next PSG. Now they're going to take Inter, who are still a sick team, but the owners just want shot. And they're going to give them a 200 million war chest to go forward. What's going on, man? It's crazy.
You've now heard of fan control football. Now we're talking about Saudi control football. It's going to be they're just going to have eight teams, aren't they? Across all leagues, and they're just going to dominate. Have four teams in the semi-finals of the Champions League every single year, and it's just going to be pure domination.
It's absolute madness. I mean, it's not. Now they're talking about Harry Kane going to Newcastle next year.
Yeah, there was wasn't there talk about Brendan Rodgers and he was just nah. He was like, I have absolutely no interest in going there. The thing is, you can have all the money you want, and you will be able to buy some of these sort of maybe just off the cusp elite players that will probably go there because they want a big payday. Of course, I'm not going to begrudge any single player for taking a four times pay increase. If somebody's offering you 400 grand a week and you're currently on 100 grand a week, of course you're going to take it. I'm not going to begrudge any player doing it, but it's going to be, some people still have morals and integrity. So you can't buy like 99% of people.
Everyone's got their price, mate. Everyone's got their price.
So it'd be interesting to see, what Newcastle do first and foremost, but I mean, do Inter really need? They've already got aren't they already swimming in money anyway? They've got big owners, haven't they? I think aren't they UAE owners? Are they UAE backed owners?
Yeah, they're Chinese. The company's called Suning, and I think what's happened is the company itself isn't broke, but Inter Milan as an asset is becoming just not worth its while. And obviously, because you have to pump millions and millions into it, and then it's like, you probably have to wait for the windfall of TV rights and that the next year and all that kind of stuff. And I think they just can't be arsed of it. So,
well, unfortunately, the Chinese are starting to find out that football clubs are not very good commercial ventures. They're starting to realize that. I think they bought the football clubs as a way of making an extra bit of money. They thought it was a good business investment, but actually they're terrible business investments. Football clubs are the worst business investments you can make. Whereas the Saudi and Middle Eastern controlled consortiums do not care, that they have too much money and they don't know what to do with it. So the big difference there is they are treating it more as, and we spoke about this last week, it's more of like a dick wagging exercise in their social circles. To say I bought a football club. Do you know what I mean? So it's a bit more like that. Whereas Chinese, actually, I think they genuinely wanted to make money. So there's a massive culture difference there as well. With the Chinese, they have a big saving face culture. So they don't want to admit that they failed basically. So they'll just let the club just sort of disintegrate because they're thinking, oh no, we're still doing well. We've got it under control. Actually, financially, they haven't. Do you know what I mean? So until the very last minute where, all right, if they can come in and pay Suning what they've spent, they'll be like, all right, fair enough. That's success for us. Do you know what I mean? We haven't lost any money. So it's a very interesting dynamic, isn't it?
I think you've summed it up perfectly there in terms of it is a cultural difference, isn't it? Because buying Newcastle United for 300 million is like having an apartment in the Burj Khalifa. It's just not worth it, but it's just something you can say you've got. And something you can say you've spent this amount of money and you can
should I buy a new yacht this year or should I buy a football club? We'll go and buy a football club this year.
We bought a football club.
Yeah, we had a 300 million yacht last year, so we'll have a football club this year.
That's mental, isn't it? That's pretty much a like-for-like thing, isn't it? Because yachts do cost that amount of money.
I'm not sure what's going to lose more money because at the end of the day, say the maintenance on a yacht, let's say maintenance on a yacht per year is $2 million. Just off the top of the head, I have no idea what the maintenance costs on a yacht might be. Whereas maintenance costs on a football club are exponentially higher than that because at the end of the day, you've got to keep on pumping money into a club until you have success in it. So football clubs are literally like, it's a losing battle, man. Buying a football club is a losing battle because you can't have consistent success.
And also, you can't throw that many dead bodies off the Sports Direct Arena with a yacht. You're absolutely sweet, aren't you?
True. So there's a big advantage there, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? How many journalists can you hide in a football club? You can't. In the sea, you can hide as many as you want. So there you go. Go on, tell us about number five then, because this had me on the back foot, man.
Mate, this is so funny, man. And I just thought of you and Pizzy straight away. So after England and was it Andorra the other night? 5-0 Merkin.
Yeah, the Merkage, yeah.
Yeah, and so they're in the studio afterwards on ITV and they're basically drooling over Phil Foden. And to be fair, from the highlights that they were showing, he was absolutely killing it. I'm used to seeing him on the wing, but he was pinging passes from deep like nobody's business. Like he was on the training field, basically. Then Roy Keane turns around and says, I love my American football. He's like Tom Brady. I was just like,
he does. He's watched one game in his life. He's watched the Super Bowl once in 2018, did he?
He called it his American football, man. It was so jokes. I was screwing. I only seen that yesterday. I'd have been straight on the WhatsApp group if I seen that in real time.
When you first wrote this, I'm glad that you give it a bit more context now because it does make a little bit more sense. In terms of the positions that he was taking up on the field and his passing ability, yeah, I can see the comparison there between Brady and Foden. But, I mean, there's a far stretch. Tom Brady's like... Like, I know he wasn't literally his successes, but oh my God. But Phil Foden, at the end of the day, he was playing against like busmen. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was playing against nobodies, man. Like, honestly, nobodies. Players that were in the fifth and sixth division of like Spanish and French football. So, this is something that we will get onto a little bit more. We'll do like a quick sort of review of the dreaded international break, which I don't know why they keep coming around so quickly like this year. Is it because we're missing out on qualifiers from you know, over the COVID period that were pushed back and then we're having to like get them all in at once, but it's just terrible. Well,
there were three types of internationals going on. So there were World Cup qualifiers, there was the Nations League, and then there were just standard friendlies all going on at once.
Oh, fun.
And it proper fun. But to be fair, the Mickey Mouse Nations League, as you said, there were some wicked games in that, you know, like was it France beat Belgium? And then was that in the final?
Yeah, because it was France versus Spain in the final, wasn't it? But France came from behind to beat Belgium
2-0 down.
3-2, yeah.
And for the Mbappe, absolutely killing it, man. I was watching all the highlights and that he was electric. And I was thinking, I could get used to seeing this kind of player. He's been, I don't know if he's been off the pace, but since I've been watching him consistently, I've been wondering what all the hype's about, to be honest. And
yeah, you're not a massive fan, are you? You know what I mean? So you're not completely, same with Haaland, but Haaland, you're starting to warm up to Haaland, aren't you? I think just because he's so consistent at the minute, do you know what I mean? He's scoring goals like every time he steps on the field, but I can understand it. Mbappe can be a little bit hit and miss. I think it's the way he plays. So he's very, very, high risk, high reward orientated. You know what I mean? So he'll always be playing on the edge. He'll always try and take players on and beat players. So there's going to be times where he loses the ball. Whereas a possession-based footballer, they might look very good. Like, say, I know a different position, like Iniesta, always looking to pass the ball whenever he can. Those football players look great. You're like, he's just passed the ball off and he's moved and he's received the ball there. Brilliant. And then every now and then he'll be able to sort of like beat two or three players based on his dribbling ability. But I think Mbappe's qualities lie in his sort of like his pace and his ability to beat players one-on-one. And of course, it's not going to come off all the time. So like when it does come off, it looks great. When it don't come off, it's like, oh, what's he doing there? Do you know what I mean? But what about his goal though? Do you think was it Benzema or was it his goal that looked offside? The one in the final against Spain, because they went 1-0 down, didn't they? And then there was a very contentious decision on the offside. So it looked, for me, he looked offside.
Let's have a look now, because I don't remember seeing anything. So as if Spain are bouncing back, man.
I've seen Pedri. He's signed a new contract with Barcelona and it's got a 1 billion euro release clause.
1 billion?
Yeah.
Need that cash, don't they, man?
I know, yeah. So somebody wants to come in and get him.
They need that cash. Spain's goal was good, though. Or is that our boy, Oyarzabal?
Oyarzabal. We did have like a two-hour conversation with Flynn about how to pronounce his name. Oyarzabal. No, it's like Oyarzabal. Oyarzabal.
That's a bad boy goal from Benzema, that is, you know. No, that is class. A bad boy goal.
Class.
No hint of offside there. No, oh my, straight, it hit the inside of the post. Have that free little touch.
FIFA goals, man.
FIFA oh my, goals. Yeah, FIFA goals all day long. He's right, man. I think it's coming up now, Mbappe as well. Oh, I've freeze framed it now on the Sky Sports football highlights. 3 minutes, 32 seconds, and he looks offside.
Yeah, I don't understand, like, why that wasn't given offside. It looks for a million miles that he's about a yard, half a yard offside.
Doesn't even look close, really. Yeah,
I right. think VAR was available there to the referees as well during that game, I believe. But to be honest, I didn't do too much research into the footy this week, and I sort of like briefly saw the goals. The game's running in the background, but yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where we go from there, because there's a lot of people that are sort of becoming a bit miffed with VAR and like how it really is. Is it really improving the quality of the game? And then you have decisions like this that are a bit contentious. So who knows? But we'll move on to the England World Cup qualifiers. There was obviously that comfortable win against Latlustra Andorra. As I put here, Foden looking great in a deep in position, picking up the ball, playing delicate forward balls. First two assists were basically down to him. One directly and one with that clip ball into Sancho. He laid it off and then Chilwell scored. So Jack Grealish got his first goal as well. But once again, this is against players that are playing in the fifth and sixth tiers of Spanish football, essentially. So, you know, you have to take these sort of performances with a pinch of salt. And Roy King, you know, comparing it to Tom Brady. All right, if Tom Brady's playing against a team from the fan control football league, then then yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's probably they're not playing against an NFL franchise, are they? Do you know what I mean? It's not Tampa Bay Bucks versus like Detroit Lions or any sort of million, you know, even a bad team in the NFL. These are like a really, really, really weak team.
This is where you've got to question the value of qualifiers, like the early qualifiers especially, like, because when you get to a tournament, there's going to be two or three really poor teams and everyone else is going to be levels, man. So like, what's the point, man? I suppose you do have to have some kind of qualifying system, but playing these lads isn't going to teach you anything. The only thing it's going to do is give you a bit of confidence. But then we see England draw to Hungary in the next game. So they weren't really that confident, were they?
Exactly. You know what I mean? And, you know, you talk about these qualifiers, we're playing the Andorras, the San Marinos, Maltas, these teams that have players that have never even played in a top European league. You know, sort of 95% of the players have never played in a top European league. They're not professionals. They're semi-pros. They have other jobs. They're policemen, they're doctors, they're dentists, they're ticket wardens or whatever. So, how, you know, is there a potential in the future for a system where we have like sort of like a super league of international teams that essentially are guaranteed a place in the World Cup or the Euros? So let's say 32 teams in the World Cup, 24 of them are guaranteed. So your Italy's, your Spain's, your England's, the teams that you want to see, Netherlands, Portugal, although there's some of those teams haven't qualified for the World Cup and the Euros in recent times, I could see a scenario where 24 out of 32 teams are guaranteed. And then the qualifiers are made up of those last six or eight places or whatever it might be. So they play for the last eight places with all these sort of smaller teams where it's a bit more competitive and they have more chance of qualifying, essentially.
Well, what about every team, or like you said, the same amount, like 24 teams, they have to have a certain amount of players, a certain percentage of players who play in the top flight of whatever country they're in. Something yeah. like that. But then again, that would contribute to like a really top-heavy approach at club level, because a player's not going to want to stay at like a top six team, even though they want to stay there and they're getting paid, because they might want international honours. They might just move to United
good.
Or something.
Which would be good. And then, you know, you got players like Jesse Lingard in 2018 when he wasn't playing for United and didn't score. He moved to West Ham, which was great for his career. It was good for West Ham. He moved there. He played well. He got his chance back in the England team. So that actually would promote players, rather than getting a paycheck, because they want to play international football. They want to go and win their place back in the international team. They're going to have to move to maybe a club that isn't as high profile to go and like win their place back in the international team. So it'd actually probably make football as a whole better if they did something like that. Yeah, if they had a percentage. Maybe not percentage, but it'd be interesting to see how it'd work out. But something along those lines would definitely work.
Yeah, to make the overall quality better, because no one I've ever spoken to enjoys they're breaking the league to watch these shit qualifiers.
At the end of the day, teams like Andorra would have more of a chance to qualify. Because at the end of the day, these teams, Andorra, San Marino, Liechtenstein, Malta, all these teams have no chance to qualify for the World Cup, zero chance, because they're in a group with like Hungary, who they're not going to beat, England, Poland, San Marino, okay, they beat 3-0, I think, midweek. But that's their only game that they're going to win. If they're playing with teams like Andorra, Liechtenstein, Malta, San Marino, if you've got, say, similar quality, so the quality is a lot more closer matched, you have more chance of these teams progressing. Do you know what I mean? So it would actually be an advantage for them as well. And I'm sure they'd probably buy into it. All right, yeah, they probably love coming to Wembley and playing in front of like 60,000 or whatever it is. You know, they probably like it for 90 minutes. But on the greater scheme of things, they want to play in the major competitions. So I think that would give them more of a chance of qualifying. So I think international football is due a shake-up for sure.
Yeah, that's more to do with how they decide the fixtures, isn't it, really? Like, they should have a system maybe based on the rankings, like this portion, like the top portion. But that means that some of the powerhouses of international football, the most commercially viable teams, are going to miss out. And that's not on, is it? Because they need more viewers, they need more money and all that. So that's probably why that doesn't happen anyway.
Yeah, but it all comes down to dough. FIFA also don't want teams like Portugal missing out. And, you know, there's been instances in the past where Sweden have missed out on the finals when Zlatan Ibrahimovic has been part of that national team. So at the end of the day, FIFA and UEFA, they want the best players at their competitions, don't they? So
they
have a bit of an obligation to make sure that those sort of teams get in. But you're always going to have big players that are sort of at teams like Sweden that perhaps haven't got the team to match them. So that's always going to happen. But you want the Portugals, the Italy's, England's. You want them at every single competition.
Yeah.
It's Brazil, Argentina. You don't want them missing out, do you? When they've got players like Lionel Messi and Neymar, you want them to be in every single competition. So I can understand if it goes along the way of elitist. We spoke about England. Obviously, they had that 5-0 against Andorra. But then they have that hiccup against Hungary. But let's not blow it out of proportion. It wasn't a great performance. And although they dominate possession, failed to create enough clear-cut chances for me to be a resilient, hungry team. But the main talking point about this was the penalty decision. So where do we stand on it, Luke Shaw? Obviously, he's tried to sort of, what would you call that? Like, I don't know what you call that little double kick that he tried to do. Obviously, he could have tried to head it, couldn't he? But he's not the tallest, is he, Luke Shaw? But he can probably get his foot up higher than he can his head.
Well, it was a little bit of a, like, as you say, there was a weird little broken rhythm to the way he tried to clear the ball. But that was bullshit, man. Like, what is he supposed to do? Like, the Hungarian player is flying in with his head. Like, he's putting himself in danger. If he's not, it's like he was hoping for a collision in the box, which is probably what he was doing. Like,
yeah, he was.
And that is like, that's gamesmanship, innit? That's all part of it. But I don't think you can buck Luke Shaw for getting to the ball first and not even catching him in the head. Do you know what I mean? I don't think that's on.
Nah, and his eyes were on the ball the whole time. It's another one of those really contentious decisions in the world of refereeing. And it's kind of like by the law book, it will be a penalty. But realistically, is it fair to give a penalty in that situation and a booking as well? Because, you know, you could say, all right, is it dangerous play from Luke Shaw? Would you say it is?
Or is it
dangerous play from the player because he stuck his head in there?
Well, it's not so much that he stuck his head in, is that he went flying at the ball. So he's at least as much to blame about the danger in the situation as Luke Shaw is. I think there's always going to be an element of or a chance of catching someone in the head if you've got your foot up that high. But also, as you say, he's not the tallest. Also, you're going to get more power on the ball if you clear it out. It was the most sensible decision that he made. And he's got penalised for it. And I think the yellow card is more like doubling down, because if you give that as a penalty and you don't give a yellow card, you're basically admitting you fucked up, innit? So that's what I think's happened there. But like, as you say, man, England weren't like that impressive anyway. I think, was it Stones got the header?
Yeah, we got back level on a set piece. Once again, we looked more dangerous from corners and free kicks, much like we did in the Euros. And that seemed to get us by again. It's not a great result. Hungary haven't beat us in 60 years or something. So that's a good result for them. And we just didn't really create enough chances from open play. Obviously, Southgate reverted back to his kind of like, I would say his starting 11. And/or he tried out a few different things, gave other players opportunities. We reverted back to having the likes of Harry Kane, Mason Mount. I think Jordan Henderson played in the first game. I think Declan Rice and Calvin Phillips came back in for the Hungary game. So it was a bit more of the team that we sort of started in the final against Italy. So, but I mean, Mason Mount, I still do not get the hype surrounding Mason Mount. He was in the shortlist for like the Ballon d'Or, I think, as well. Yeah, I just don't get that. I don't get the hype. I don't see it. I really don't.
As you well know, man, I'm not like a football aficionado, but to me, he just looked bog standard, man. Like, but average. I just don't. Yeah, I can't add anything else to what you've just said. I think he's absolutely average. I think he's lucky to be in the Chelsea team, innit?
Like, he's for me. He obviously, it's easy to say after Phil Foden's had a good performance against Andorra, but that aside, for me, Phil Foden is a much more well-rounded player than Mason Mount is. I'd much rather start him.
Yeah, that's not up for discussion, is it, man? Look at what Phil Foden's doing in big games against Liverpool and that. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's, and I actually think he's a bit like Tom Brady, man, myself, with the passes he's pulling out.
Segway to the NFL chat. I love it.
It's unreal.
So NFL, man, it was a good weekend for the NFL because your Falcons won, my Bears won. First time we've had a double win. So, like, you talk to me because you watched the Falcons game, didn't you, for the first time, I believe?
Well, as I've been saying, so I ain't got that time in my life, man. But I did watch the highlights and I pulled it up several times to kind of try and understand a little bit more what was going on. And so here's my thoughts from the game. Matt Ryan, the quarterback, he looked like he had a good game. I don't know what the stats were or anything, but he seemed to be slinging in those short mid-range passes pretty accurately in the first half, at least. And he could have suffered a bad injury in the second quarter when the Jets number 97, I don't know who it was, dived into his shins, the dirty bastard, after he'd released the ball. So, like, but first half, they were dominating, I thought. They looked like the completely better team. Obviously, those long Hail Mary type passes weren't coming off, but they're not going to, are they? He looked pretty like he was accurately distributing the ball and taking every second he could before the defensive line, like, shut him down. Do you know what I mean? So that was what I gathered for. The Falcons were up 20-3 at halftime, I think. The Jets look pretty shit. And again, I don't know really what I'm watching, but they look pretty shit to me. They couldn't really get anything going. Their quarterback was atrocious. Am I saying this right? The Falcons were gaining yards when they shouldn't have really been gaining yards, if that makes any sense. Like, yeah. Jets players were just flying past them. Like, and they weren't even like making any mad, like swervy, like any given Sunday type runs, man.
Not Jamie doing any clever routes.
No clever routes at all. But as I said there, man, they must have had an Al Pacino style bollocking at halftime, because in the third quarter, and it's really weird for me to refer to games by quarters rather than halves, but they were all of a sudden finding space through the middle. And they got what's it called now? Let me just go to the notes. They got a second touchdown, the Jets did, after a pass interference, which I have no idea why this is a rule. Is it like, it's basically like a penalty kick and it that close to the end zone? What did he do? He pulled on his shirt or something like that?
I didn't see the highlights, but a pass interference is essentially when the ball's thrown and it's going towards a wide receiver being the attacking player, the cornerback or anybody in the secondary will be the defensive player. If you engage the catcher before the ball gets to him, it's pass interference. So you can't tug or push or like really make any sort of contact with him before the ball gets there. When the ball's coming, you can make a play on the ball. But if you do it before, if you do it too early, it's going to be pass interference. And then they spot the ball at the spot of the foul. So wherever the foul is, that's where they spot the ball.
That makes sense. So that's what happened with the Jets. And it was right next to the end zone. So obviously they got the touchdown from there. I think they converted afterwards. And then all of a sudden they were back in the game. Like, it's mad how that quick, just one touchdown can pretty much change the momentum, can't it? Like a massive jump in points.
Yeah.
But after that, the Falcons, they pretty much just held it down and they got one more touchdown after that. There was like 50 of them that just all holding the ball, running across the end zone together. And it was one of those things where I was like, oh, that's not the worst thing I've ever watched, really. Like, that Matt Ryan was pretty good. I enjoyed watching him. Number 8, I think, is it Briggs or Riggs or something like that? He got his first touchdown in the game. He's some like rookie. And there was another one, as another player that I thought, oh, he looks pretty tasty when he's like taking his inventive routes down the field, getting yards.
Calvin Ridley, maybe one of the wide receivers.
I think it is, Ridley. How do you know him? Like, you don't even watch the Falcons, do you?
No, but like, I know some of their, I know generally teams better players on in the wide receiver position, so he's one of them. But now, you saw me grinning like a Cheshire cat there, because I think it's amazing how far you've come along in your NFL knowledge in such a short amount of time. And I think you were spot on with a lot of that. Obviously, Zach Wilson, the Jets quarterback, he had a good game last week when they got their first win, but he's still a rookie, so he's still making a lot of mistakes. And I think that was their first win of the season, wasn't it, the Falcons? So,
yeah.
Matt Ryan's a good quarterback, man. Like, look, he's in terms of passing yards, he's well up there in terms of like the all-timers. He's a decent quarterback, so he's just not really. He's never really had a great team around him, not for quite a few years. So, so it's looking like Falcons. I think they did get to a Super Bowl final in the last, say, decade. I'm not sure when the last one was, but I'm not going to pick that off the top of my head. But we'll move on to the Bears. I mean, obviously, their defense stuck it to John Gruden's Raiders in what would be his last game as the Las Vegas franchise-based coach. So,
That's funny, man.
Possibly his last game coaching the league after the service of his derogatory emails. So, Gruden actually traded one of Bears' elite pass rushers, Khalil Mack, to the Bears in 2018. And the Bears defense, I think, have always had a chip on their shoulder since they got defeated by the Raiders in London in 2019. And after John Gruden, his son. So I need to stop saying John Gruden because that would be very defamation of character. John Gruden, not Jay Gruden. So he's he basically mocked Chicago Bears club dub, which is like when they go into the locker room after the game and like turn it into a nightclub and start like playing tunes and like dancing and shit. So John Gruden mocked them in 2019 after they won. So I think the Bears have had a bit of a chip on their shoulder since then. So it was nice to get that. I think it would have been good for them to get that revenge. So Justin Fields, obviously our rookie, he achieved his first passing touchdown of his career, 2-yard throw to tight end Jasper Horsted, which is only his second career touchdown. So on offense, standing in for stud running back David Montgomery, who's out for a few weeks, was another rookie, Khalil Herbert, who only had his second appearance in a Bears uniform. He managed 18 carries, 75 yards on a great first start for the Bears and carried their offense in what was a stellar day for the Bears defense. Raiders quarterback Derek Carr ended up with 22 of 35 completed passes with 206 yards, but had his first negative touchdown to INT differential of the season, without managing a touchdown to one INT. So great job by the Bears D to prevent the passing touchdowns, and they came out 20-9 winners. So what do you think? Do you think there's any potential for Falcons or Bears to make a playoff run, get into the Super Bowl potentially?
What do they have to do that? Do they have to finish like top two? Or?
Yeah, so they'd have to win, I'd say, at least 9 of the next 12 games. Which is
what, the Falcons is, or the
Falcons would. Oh, Bears, Falcons. Bears are a 3-2, so they've got a bit more leeway. So they would have to win a lot more games to get into the playoffs.
If they carry on playing teams like the Jets, they're a shoo-in, like, but I imagine, is it the Bucs? The Bucs are an actual sick team, though, aren't they? Like, they're in the same little league thing.
Yeah, so it's good. Yeah.
Is that South? Is it NFC South? Or what's it called? The ones the Falcons are in.
But yeah, New York Jets are probably the worst team in football at the minute, apart from the Jacksonville Jaguars, probably.
There's the Jets, the Giants, the Eagles. That's like a predatory bird playoff right there.
Yeah.
Nice. And yeah, Washington, yeah. And the Dolphins. Yeah, yeah. The Dolphins are pretty shit, aren't they?
They have been great this season. Yeah, they haven't been great. Oh, they've lost their quarterback to Tagovailoa or whatever his name is. He's been out injured, so.
Probably make the Super Bowl, to be honest.
Yeah. Should we go for a Falcons versus Bears Super Bowl?
Stick 50 on it, mate. Fuck it. Yeah, go on.
Might as well.
You don't seem too enthused by the Bears' chances, man. They've got a much better record.
Nah. They've got nothing on offense, man. Like, unless their defense restricts every team they play to 9 points, then there's no way that they can get there because their offense just ain't good enough. They ain't got any superstars, really, on their offense, apart from Allen Robinson, but we don't seem to be giving him the ball. So, yeah, I reckon we should get crack on with the combat sports, man. And obviously, it's going to be the big fight, the huge fight, one of the fights of this. Well, I'm not going to say the century. That might be a bit too much, but certainly of the decade.
I don't think that's too much at 10 all.
10 years, yeah.
No, I'm telling you, the century only started 21 years ago, mate. That
there
was
you go.
Easily one of the better fights of this century, man. I mean, there's plenty of room for it to go tits up on that prediction, but. These last couple of weeks, we've been spoiled rotten, haven't we, man? With the fights. They've been absolutely ridiculous.
Mm.
So, I think the BoxRec summary under the fight, under the result, just tells you what kind of fight it was. It says, Wilder down in rounds 3, 10, and 11. Fury down twice in round 4. That gives you an idea of how exciting the contest was. But the word sterilized, the brutality of the fight. So, if we just start at the beginning, a quick little run through of what happened, and I'll try not to get too excited because you wanted to see me on Sunday morning hopping around my living room, man. It was outrageous. So, Deontay Wilder, former champion, trying to regain his WBC heavyweight title in the third fight of this trilogy. The first fight was a draw. Second fight, he got absolutely spanked by Fury. And I got to give him all the credit in the world for even pushing for this rematch, even though it scuppered AJ Fury. Was it July? It's supposed to be in Dubai sometime. But he took Fury to court, says he wants the third stipulated fight. And he got it, man. And he came into the ring noticeably more muscled up than in the previous two fights. He began by jabbing to the body over and over again, which is a tactic we haven't seen. I think I wondered last week what would happen if he did go to the body on Fury. I did not imagine him committing that early to that kind of tactic. And to be honest, Fury looked like he was struggling to get around the jab. Until the third round when he rushed Wilder to the ropes, landed a left and a right hook, then a short uppercut that put Wilder over. And I'm not exaggerating to say that even at those early stages, in those early exchanges, Wilder looked tired, dejected. And after he got knocked down, he was in the same position he found himself in the second fight, even after he'd made those significant tactical adjustments in his approach. So he did well to escape the round. This happened time and time and again in this fight. When each fighter was in trouble, the bell just saved them. I think it happened about 5 or 6 times, which just added to the atmosphere and to the tension. He did well to escape another round after Fury brought another onslaught. And Fury, by this point, he looked like, okay, this is job done. I know I can hurt this guy. I know I can get him out of here. I've done it in the second fight. I've got him down in the third round. Let me just go forward. And he got careless, man. And in the exchange that led up to the next significant moment in the fight, Wilder was turning away to his left and he threw out a left hook that just looked dog tired, man. And I don't blame Fury for thinking that Wilder was done, but he got careless and he walked forward straight into a 1-2 that Wilder just pulled out of his ass pocket. I said to you on the Sunday that that punch landed on his forehead and it rippled down his back fat. Do you know what I mean? The next thing to shake were his legs. Then he went over and then he looked hurt, man. He looked really hurt, but he got up. He's bouncing around. The referee gave him all the time in the world. He did this to both fighters throughout the night. And I think there was talk about Fury getting a long count. Listen, Wilder got a lot of long counts too. And it was all the better for the contest. But when Fury got up after his first knockdown, they just traded up. And I was just thinking, what is going on, man? You put both of them. Were putting themselves in a mad situation. And then Wilder landed a left hook on the ear, dropped in again, and then Fury looked really hurt, man. Like he was breathing heavy, he was propped up on one elbow, looking a bit bewildered. And I think Wilder was just jumping forward to get on top of him. The ref had to ease him away to a neutral corner, which gave Fury some really like crucial seconds to recover himself. The bell rang straight after. And then we're into a fifth round that has just gone all over the place in terms of point scoring, in terms of knockdown, in terms of which fighters hurt. So what were your thoughts on the fight up to this point? Like, get to about the halfway stage. What were you thinking was going to happen? I had no clue what was coming next.
Yeah, well, ever since that recovery from Wilder in the fourth, because you thought it was game over after the third. You really thought that Wilder was going to come out, Fury's going to put the same sort of pressure on him and it was going to be game over. So it was, you know, it wasn't until rewatching it back this morning, because obviously I think you have to, man, especially a fight of this magnitude and the quality and the excitement that it gave you. You have to rewatch it, because like watching it in the casino when you're steaming and everyone's getting excited. I watched it in a Philadelphia casino. And to be honest, there was a lot of people backing Wilder, which surprised me.
Screwing.
Surprised me, because I thought that it'd probably be a bit half and half, because I've heard that, like, you know, in America, Wilder, it probably isn't as people don't take to him as much as they probably should. But I think after this fight, I think his respect and credibility has gone up hugely for American sports, American boxing fans. But I think you hit the nail on the head with Wilder came out with a game plan unlike basically we've ever seen from him in his career. He always had confidence in his ability to not like knock anyone out in previous fights. But I think he came into this fight with the idea that, all right, he's going to try and get that jab working, which did, I think, for large periods of the fight until he started to really tire. I think he boxed much more effectively than I've ever seen him. Both fighters looked like they could finish the fight at any moment from the sixth, like fifth and sixth. They were like fighting with the volume of punches that they were fighting with. They had sort of the technical ability and the volume of punches of like middleweights, but with the power of like these absolute titans, these huge men, 20 stone and 17 stone, like the biggest heavyweight of all time. But they were boxing like they were just like, you know, trading punches like nothing, man. Like you were watching Canelo versus like Golovkin, man. That's the sort of like volume of punches they were trading with. So it was just absolutely incredible. And I think Fury struggled with the 18-month layoff between the two fighters more. Do you know what I mean? I think he really struggled with it. He wasn't as sharp for me. We didn't see as much bobbing and weaving the head movement that we saw in the first and second fights. And this allowed Wilder to gain a foothold in the fight. But it's going to go down as a trilogy for the ages, isn't it? Just like a momentous and legend-defining moment for both fighters.
It was more than we could have ever hoped for. And by now, we've only come up to like the fifth round, what we're talking about. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's just half the fight.
Yeah, the main difference for me after Fury got knocked down, I think he came into the fight thinking, I know I can knock this guy out. I don't have to be as careful as I have been in the first fight and in the second fight. And I think that nearly cost him his title, man, and his undefeated record, because he was hurt bad. Not probably as bad as he was hurt in the first fight, which is mad to say. This is the thing, he knows he can get up, but he put a lot of trust in his ability to take that punishment. And that is a very dangerous game plan against a punch a lot Wilder. But this was the intrigue in the fight coming into it.
Yeah, but
the main adjustment that he made after the fifth was his jab. It was like a shotgun, man. After he started landing that jab and not rushing in so much, because he knew he could get hurt and he had been hurt and probably still was hurt after the fourth round, he believed in his jab. And after that, for me, even though Wilder presented occasions where he looked like he really hurt Fury, especially at the end of the ninth round, where it looked like Wilder just said, fuck this, I'm throwing my right hand. And he threw like four or five of them in a row and clipped Fury. And Fury kind of fell into him as if he was hurt. And then the bell rang again. It was mental how often that happened. But on balance, from the fifth round onwards, I think Fury was breaking him down. And I think he was rushing him to the ropes, like pretty much running at him and landing that right hand. And then he was pulling his head down, landing that sneaky uppercut again. And then that was kind of the difference for me. And then when Wilder would turn back into the center of the ring, Fury was able to follow him, switch his stances and throw that extra punch to keep him off guard and keep him off balance and keep him kind of guessing and flinching away. Because we did say it last week, you can work on what you're going to work on, but if you're in your mid-30s, you're going to revert to type, aren't you? When shit gets real,
when you're getting bashed up, you just are going to go instinctively, you're just going to revert back to what you know, innit? No matter how much you've been training in the last 2 months and how much of a game plan you've got, like when you're getting your head knocked about, you are just going to revert back to what you know, aren't you?
That sounds like a criticism towards Wilder, but I can't overstate how much I admire his bravery, because he was fucked, man. He was absolutely fucked at the end of the third round. He looked done. His mouth was hanging open. He was just shaking his head like, fuck, I've just been working for 18 months to not let that happen. It's just happened straight away to me. And I had him winning the first two rounds. So he's built up a little bit of confidence as well. Do you know what I mean?
And then he had the 10-7 in the fourth. So like you could argue that after six, seven rounds, he was still ahead.
Yeah, I would argue that, to be honest with you. But then Fury just, I think if you want to break it down to simple terms, Fury just outmanned him, man. And it just came down to that. It came down to a battle of wills. And because it was a battle of wills, I think that's why Wilder stood in there for so long. He's a proud fella, you know. He did not want that to happen to him again. And I said to you as well, Malik Scott, his trainer, his friend, first time he had him in the corner after he sat Mark Breland, he was never going to throw in that towel. Nah. I think they had that conversation. He said, mate, you better not fucking throw in that towel. And Wilder made it so he had to get stretchered out. And then that's what happened in the end, man.
And you know what? It was like listening to Malik Scott and the other guy that's in his corner. Can't remember his name. But they kept on reiterating the fact that, oh, God's give you this ability to be able to knock any man in like on the planet out. Use it. He kept on using the word lackadaisical to Wilder. He said, you're getting lackadaisical. He's like, you need to do this, you need to do that. Don't forget, you've always got the ability, the God-given ability to knock this guy out. Do you know what I mean? God gave you this ability for a reason. And I think that was keeping him going, man. Yeah. That was keeping him going every single round, even when he was getting punished, man. He just kept on thinking, I can knock this guy out. And obviously that fourth round was proof that he could.
Yeah,
when he got later in the fight, it was just like, to be honest, it was a bit painful to watch at times because like he was taking some serious punishment, man.
Yeah, absolutely. And I thought both corners were tremendous. I thought Malik Scott, as you say, he was giving him technical advice, but it was also appealing to him emotionally. At one point, really late in the fight, it might have even been the 10th. He's like, listen, man, stick in there. You'll be so proud of yourself.
That was it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was just thinking, man, that is exactly what this guy needs to hear right now. And in the opposite corner, Sugar Hill, he's telling Fury, stick behind your jab. He cannot touch you if you stay behind your jab. And every time he threw his jab, it was like, boom, boom. But this wasn't no flicking, like little feint to touch him up then move. This was a jab to hurt him and to land that right hand behind it. The sequence that Fury landed in attempt for that knockdown, he blocked the body shot with his elbow, rolled under a left hook from Wilder, and then clipped him with a right hook and dropped him. That was textbook boxing from a guy who's 20 stone, 6'8", in the 10th round of an absolute war. It was sick. It was high quality on all levels. And then, as you say, in the 11th round, Fury's manoeuvred him into the corner and just let rip. And that final right hook was one of a few really like clean knockouts on the Saturday night, man. It was like, boom, good night. And he just kind of, he was right next to the ropes and you could just see the life had left him. The ref didn't even bother to count. I thought the ref was tremendous as well.
Yeah, he did, to be honest. And obviously, there has been a lot of talk about the slow counts. Fury's the second one in the fourth round. So the second time he went down, there was about, I would say, a 2 or 3 second gap between the fifth and sixth second call. So there was a gap, man. But as you say, I think he gave Wilder time to recover during his knockdowns as well.
Yeah, well, I think he told Wilder to go back to the neutral corner, and that's what caused the extra delay for the second. Because I think Wilder was itching to get in, do you know what I mean? And ironically, in doing so, cost himself for like a bit more time. But as I say, the corners were tremendous. The referee was amazing, like, which is something I don't say very often. And
both fighters were incredible as well.
You cannot say more about the fighters, man. I'll always be a fan. No matter what Deontay Wilder says about after the second fight, I don't care about all that. And even I don't really care about like him not showing sportsmanship after the fight. It's up to him, isn't it? He just put himself through 11 rounds of absolute punishment, suffering, and battled on until he was basically unconscious. What more can you ask for from a fighter, man? You really can't.
Nothing.
So yeah, he was absolute. Oh, I want to watch it again.
Yeah, well, I mean, what a contrast really to the Joshua versus Usyk fight, which was just under a month, which feels like a lifetime ago after we've watched that. But obviously a contrast in styles of the fight. But is it any wonder that Joshua has been sort of avoiding these two fighters for so long? Mate, there's no wonder, man.
Joshua wouldn't have been able to stick in there, I don't think. Not that he wouldn't have been able to, but I think he would have just made the decision not to carry on because
I don't think he's got anywhere near the mental resolve that those two fighters showed in that fight on the weekend.
I don't think he's ever had to. I mean, look at the first Ruiz fight where he got knocked out. He did keep getting up, you know. He got stopped on his feet. I think a lot of people forget about that. He kept getting up.
You look at Andy Ruiz and compare them to them two juggernauts that were in the ring on Saturday night. Do you know what I mean? There's a big difference between getting up from the punches of those two fighters. Come on, man.
No, that's true. I agree with you, to be honest. And I think Wilder would knock out AJ. But it depends how much he took a lot of damage in that fight. You know, I don't think he's going to be the same after that. So maybe if you catch him at the right time, a year or two down the line, AJ could just box him up and just still be fresh enough to do it to him. But
I hope he can come back from that, and you know, and look, that AJ fight would be great. And if Wilder did get out there and beat AJ, you're not going to win back your titles unless obviously he beats Usyk in the rematch. But it's hard to say, isn't it? Would Joshua then fight Fury? There's been talks about Fury retiring. So, like, where does it go from here? The heavyweight division? We have no idea what's going to happen. That's what makes it so every single fight, every touted fight will be treated with so much intrigue because we just do not know where this division's going.
Yeah, I heard, I read somewhere that they were going to put the AJ Usyk rematch on the back burner. Let Fury and Usyk fight for the Undisputed, then obviously hoping that Fury wins the Undisputed title, then have Fury AJ. That does make the most sense to me, man. Like,
I feel like that's giving AJ just like, I don't know, man. That's like an easy pass, easy route. Like, he got completely outboxed by Usyk. Let him put his fucking career on the line. Go and fight Usyk again. Let him put his career on the line. If he loses that, then he's done. He can go and fight Wilder then. And then obviously Fury and Usyk can battle it out and see if Usyk's good enough to beat all the heavyweights in this division.
The fairest thing to do is what you've just said, but there's boxing way more.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There's way more money.
Yeah, yeah.
There's way more money in Fury AJ. There's probably 3-4 times as much money in Fury AJ as either Fury Usyk or AJ Usyk the rematch.
It's hard to say what to do, and it like fucking hell. Like, let's leave it up to the promoters. That's going to be their job, man. And like,
they can sort it
out.
But for the moment, we should just bask in the like them two guys. Yeah, that was an all timer for me. That's on the list. That is on the list, man. And there's not much more. There's no higher praise I can give it. I think it stands the test of time.
And Tyson Fury, best heavyweight of his generation, without a doubt.
I can't think of a heavyweight that would give him trouble going back as far as Lennox Lewis, to be honest with you. And now we're talking, 20 years, his generation. I think he outboxed Klitschko. I think he'd beat the other Klitschko. I think Mike Tyson, just too big. Who else? I think he's already proven he's better than Wilder. I don't even see the AJ fight as being competitive at the moment, to be honest with you. And then you're looking at, who else is there? Oh, all the other people that this current generation have made their names off, Fury bashed a lot of them.
And don't forget, this wasn't a Fury in prime condition. This wasn't a depleted Fury that was probably a little bit too overweight and had 18 months outside the ring. If he fights again in 6 months and, you know, really trims down and really focuses on his next opponent, he's just going to be better, man. He's just going to get better and better.
You know, it's a scary thing. I think the second fight against Wilder is probably the best Fury we're ever going to see, because he was just heavy enough to be a destructive puncher, just light enough to be moving well on his feet, durable enough, and also tactically tuned in. He took risks when he needed to, when he had to close the distance, but he wasn't as reckless as he was in this fight. Now, this fight was a better contest, a more entertaining watch, a more punishing, brutal thing. But in terms of his performance, I think we've actually seen the best of him now. I think we're on the other side of Tyson Fury, which pains me to say.
That's fair enough. Yeah. I mean, let's not forget that fight with an extra 30 seconds in that third round, that fight was over.
Yeah.
Wilder was in trouble. He got saved by the bell, which Fury did as well, obviously in the fourth. But with an extra 30 seconds, like, and we're so blessed that he went to the 11th, man.
I genuinely feel like it went pretty much as late as it could go and still get a knockout and a resounding clean.
Perfect.
It weren't no short count from the ref. There was nothing you could criticize that fight for. It's such a nice feeling to say that about a boxing fight, man. There's always something to pick up on and go, oh, that was a bit shit, or like da da da. But it was perfect, man.
That's the reason why we watch the sport, and it is for fights like that, man.
But it was a mad weekend of boxing altogether. I'll just quickly run through the results here. Liam Smith stopped Dante Fowler in the 8th round. That was an absolute war in the main event of the Zones card. Troy Williamson versus Ted Cheeseman for the British Super Welterweight Championship. That could go down as domestic fight of the year. Talk about clean knockouts. That was the same kind of thing from Fury and Wilder, just with a left hook. And Jason Cunningham defended his British, European and Commonwealth super bantamweight titles against Brad Foster, which is a fight I haven't seen yet, but there was only a point in it on each of the judges' scorecards. So you can imagine that was a close one. BT Sports haven't got it up yet, which is a bit of a weird one. They're usually like pretty shit hot on that. This weekend, it's Emmanuel Navarrete and who else? Mikey Garcia's back. There's also Chris Eubank Jr.'s in action. Huey Fury against Christian Hammer. Savannah Marshall defending her middleweight world title. All good stuff. I can't imagine it's going to... It simply can't match the heights of last weekend because of status and titles and personalities and all that. But boxing, the UFC... we've had a good run, man. We've had a good run.
We need a breather, don't we? We just need a breath of fresh air for the weekend. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Focus on something else.
Exactly, man.
Play some games for the weekend. Just like try and like just have wallow in that absolute like amazing spectacle that we were given. And then obviously we got some fantastic UFC cards coming up as well, haven't we? And I think one at the end of this month, one in November. So the combat sports train just keeps on rolling, man.
Can't believe it, man. But yeah. There is more UFC next week. It's a pretty low level card. Again, nothing I'm too interested in, to be honest, because I think Luke Rockhold's fight got pulled. That might have been for the week after next. But yeah, we should probably finish this by saying we might have a little break in the next few weeks. So I'm sorry to say my schedule has overrun me, man. I'm no longer able to balance uni and work and the Ball Chat Sports podcast, man, with a heavy heart, because I'm absolutely gassed, man. This is like when we're talking about sports and all that, it's like one of my favorite times of the week. But the preparation, the post-production and all the other stuff that goes into it is just becoming a bit more. So we might have to take a short hiatus.
Yeah, hiatus for sure, man. We'll be back. And I will probably be back in some form before the end of the year, whether it be doing some sporting history, maybe half an hour clips where I talk about big moments in sport and I'd sort of do a monologue, or Jim's going to still chip in with some big fighting reviews. So that'll be either on the UFC cards or big boxing fights that are coming up in the future. We might do some short tidbits that we're going to put online and stuff like that. So, you know, we're still going to be here in some shape or form, but it's been a class 9 months to start. Do you know what I mean? Can't believe we've been doing this for 9 months now.
That's mental. 36 full-length episodes. Actually, no, probably 35, because we had that 1 week where we both kind of chipped in with short bits. And that might be the... to be honest with you, I can see that being the format that it takes from here on. Still under the Ball Chat Sports banner, but tidbits here and there, probably 5 to 10 minutes from me, whatever Bissett can find the time for, and probably getting a little bit more active on the socials in terms of polls and stuff like that. And might even, like, you know, we can even get a few sound bites from Tino and Flynn, but we haven't got the big time demands of a full length episode. So yeah, it's not the end, but it's a little break, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, and that's closing. We're closing on 1,000 viewers. So thank you to everybody that has that's been sort of like supporting us as we go through doing this. Because obviously, you know, it takes up a lot of time. Do you know what I mean? And doing the script during the week, making sure we're focused on all the different, like, you know, aspects of the sport, trying to juggle, you know, two jobs or juggling jobs and studying, you know, for your course that you're doing. So obviously, you know, we don't want to pat ourselves on the back too much, but it has been tough to fit it all in. Do you know what I mean? So at the end of the day, we're thank you to everyone that listens and that takes time to listen to an hour and a half episode, because I can understand that that's a big time out of somebody's day as well, isn't it?
Oh man, stuff. You're making me just go head first into it. Drop work, drop uni, and just be a full-time podcaster, man.
That's it. If someone gives us 50 grand, like head start, we'll get some capital, then absolutely, yeah, we'll drop everything and just do this full time. one episode a day.
Oh, that'd be so sick, wouldn't it? But yeah, I think that's the perfect place to end it, mate. It's been a pleasure as always, Bissett, mate.
Yep, and it always will be a pleasure in the future, mate. So I'll speak to you soon.